Ride, You Tonto Raiders by Louis L'Amour. 1. The rain, which had been falling steadily for 3 days, had turned the trail into a sloppy river of mud. Peering through the slanting downpour, Mathurin Saber cursed himself for the quixotic notion that impelled him to take this special trail to the home of the man that he had gunned down. Nothing good could come of it, he reflected. Yet the thought that the young widow and child might need the money he was carrying had started him upon the long ride from El Paso to the Mogollons. Certainly neither the bartender nor the hangers-on in the saloon could have been entrusted with that money, and nobody was taking that dangerous ride to the Tonto Basin for fun. Matt Saber was no trouble hunter. At various times he had been many things, most of them associated with violence. By birth and inclination he was a Western man, although much of his adult life had been lived far from his native country. He had been a buffalo hunter, a prospector, and for a short time a two-gun marshal of a tough cattle town. It was his stubborn refusal either to back up or back down that kept him in constant hot water. Yet some of his trouble derived from something more than that. It stemmed from a dark and bitter drive toward violence, a drive that lay deeply within him. He was aware of this drive, and held it in restraint, but at times it welled up, and he went smashing into trouble. A big, rugged, and dangerous man who fought like a Viking gone berserk, except that he fought coldly and shrewdly. He was a tall man, heavier than he appeared, and his lean, dark face had a slightly patrician look with high cheekbones and green eyes. His eyes were usually quiet and reserved. He had a natural affinity for horses and weapons. He understood them, and they understood him. It had been love of a good horse that brought him to his first act of violence. He had been buffalo hunting with his uncle and had interfered with another hunter who was beating his horse. At 16, a buffalo hunter was a man and expected to stand as one. Matt Saber stood his ground and shot it out, killing his first man. Had it rested there, all would have been well, but two of the dead man's friends had come hunting Saber. Failing to find him, they had beaten his ailing uncle and stolen the horses. Matt Saber trailed them to Mobidi and killed them both in the street, taking his horses home. Then he left the country to prospect in Mexico, fight a revolution in Central America, and join the Foreign Legion in Morocco, from which he deserted after 2 years. Returning to Texas, he drove a trail herd up to Dodge, then took a job as marshal of a town. 6 months later, in El Paso, he had become engaged in an altercation with Billy Curtin, and Curtin had called him a liar and gone for his gun. With that incredible speed that was so much a part of him, Matt drew his gun and fired. Curtin hit the floor. An hour later, he was summoned to the dying man's hotel room. Billy Curtin, his dark, tumbled hair against the folded blanket, his face drawn and deathly white, was dying. They told him outside the door that Curtin might live an hour or even two. He could not live longer. Tall, straight, and quiet, Saber walked into the room and stood by the dying man's bed. Curtin held a packet wrapped in oilskin.
$5,000, he whispered. Take it to my wife, to Jenny, on the Pivot Rock, and the Mogollons. She's in trouble.
It was a curious thing that this dying man should place a trust in the hands of the man who had killed him. Saber stared down at him, frowning a little. "Why me?" he asked. "You trust me with this? And why should I do it?"
You're a gentleman. I trust you to help her. Will you? I was a hot-headed fool. Worried. Impatient. It wasn't your fault."
The reckless light was gone from the blue eyes, and the light that remained was fading. "I'll do it, Curtin. You've my word. You've got the word of Matt Saber. For an instant, then, the blue eyes blazed widely and sharply with knowledge.
You're Saber?
Matt nodded. But the light had faded, and Billy Curtin had bunched his herd. It had been a rough and bitter trip, but there was little farther to go. West of El Paso there had been a brush with marauding Apaches. In Silver City, two strangely familiar riders had followed him into a saloon and started a brawl. Yet Matt was too wise in the ways of thieves to be caught by so obvious a trick, and he had slipped away in the darkness after shooting out the light. The roan slipped now on the muddy trail, scrambled up, and moved on through the trees. Suddenly, in the rain-darkened dusk, there was one light, then another.
"Yellow Jacket," Matt said with a sigh of relief.
"That means a good bed for us, boy. A good bed and a good feed." Yellow Jacket was a jumping-off place. It was a stage station and a saloon, a livery stable, and a ramshackle hotel. It was a cluster of adobe residences and some false-fronted stores. It bunched its buildings in the corner of Copper Creek. It was Galusha Reed's town, and Reed owned the Yellow Jacket Saloon and the Rincon Mine. Sid Trumbull was town marshal, and he ran the place for Reed. Wherever Reed rode, Tony Sykes was close by, and there were some who said that Reed in turn was owned by Prince McCarran, who owned the big PM brand in the Tonto Basin country. Matt Saber stabled his horse and turned to the slope-shouldered liveryman. "Give him a bait of corn. Another in the morning."
"Corn?" Simpson shook his head. "We've no corn."
"You have corn for the freighter's stock and corn for the stage horses. Give my horse corn." Saber had a sharp ring of authority in his voice, and before he realized it, Simpson was giving the big roan his corn. He thought about it and stared after Saber. The tall rider was walking away, a light, long step, easy and free on the balls of his feet. And he carried two guns, low-hung and tied down. Simpson stared, then shrugged.
"A bad one," he muttered. "Wish he'd kill Sid Trumbull."
Matt Saber pushed into the door of the Yellow Jacket and dropped his saddlebags to the floor. Then he strode to the bar.
"What have you got, man? Anything but rye?" "What's the matter? Ain't rye good enough for you?"
The bartender, a man named Hobbs, was sore himself. No man should work so many hours on feet like his.
"Have you brandy? Or some Irish whiskey?"
Hobbs stared.
"Mister, where do you think you are? New York?"
"That's all right, Hobbs. I like a man who knows what he likes. Give him some of my cognac."
Matt Saber turned and glanced at the speaker. He was a tall man, immaculate in black broadcloth, with blonde hair slightly wavy and a rosy complexion. He might have been 30 or older. He wore a pistol on his left side, high up.
"Thanks," Saber said briefly. "There's nothing better than cognac on a wet night."
"My name is McCarran. I run the PM outfit east of here."
"Northeast, to be exact."
Saber nodded. "My name is Saber. I run no outfit, but I'm looking for one.
Where's the pivot rock?"
He was a good poker player, men said. His eyes were fast from using guns, and so he saw the sudden glint and the quick caution in Prince McCarran's eyes.
"The pivot rock? Why, that's a stream over in the Mogollons. There's an outfit over there, all right. A one-horse affair."
"Why do you ask?" Saber cut him off short. "Business with them."
"I see. Well, you'll find it a lonely ride. There's trouble up that way now, some sort of a cattle war."
Matt Saber tasted his drink. It was good cognac. In fact, it was the best, and he had found none west of New Orleans. McCarran, his name was. He knew something, too. Curtin had asked him to help his widow. Was the Pivot Rock outfit in the war? He decided against asking McCarran, and they talked quietly of the rain and of cattle,
then of cognac.
You never acquired a taste for cognac in the West. May I ask where?
Paris, Saber replied. Marseille, Fez, and Marrakesh.
You've been around, then?
Well, that's not uncommon. The blond man pointed toward a heavy-shouldered young man who slept with his head on his arms.
See that chap?
Calls himself Camp Gordon. He's a Cambridge man, quotes the classics when he's drunk, which is over half the time, and is one of the best cowhands in the country when he's sober. Keys over there, playing the piano, studied in Weimar. He knew Strauss in Vienna before he wrote the Blue Danube. There's all sorts of men in the West, from belted earls and remittance men to vagabond scum from all corners of the world. They are here a few weeks, and they talk the lingo like veterans. Some of the biggest ranches in the West are owned by Englishmen.
Prince McCarran talked to him a few minutes longer, but he learned nothing.
Saber was not evasive, but somehow he gave out no information about himself or his mission.
McCarran walked away very thoughtfully. Later, after Matt Saber was gone, Sid Trumbull came in.
Saber?
Trumbull shook his head.
Never heard of him. Keys might know. He knows about everybody. What's he want on the Pivot Rock?
Lying on his back in bed, Matt Saber stared up into the darkness and listened to the rain on the window and on the roof. It rattled hard, skeleton fingers against the glass, and he turned restlessly in his bed, frowning as he recalled that quick, guarded expression in the eyes of Prince McCarran. Who was McCarran, and what did he know? Had Curtin's request that he help his wife been merely the natural request of a dying man? Or had he felt that there was a definite need of help? Was something wrong here? He went to sleep, vowing to deliver the money and ride away. Yet even as his eyes closed the last time, he knew he would not do it if there was trouble. It was still raining, but no longer pouring when he awakened. He dressed swiftly and checked his guns, his mind taking up his problems where they had been left the previous night. Camp Gordon, his face puffy from too much drinking and too sound asleep, staggered down the stairs after him. He grinned woefully at Saber.
"I guess I really hung one on last night," he said. "What I need is to get out of town."
They ate breakfast together, and Gordon's eyes sharpened suddenly at Matt's query of directions to the Pivot Rock.
"You'll not want to go there, man. Since Curtin ran out, they've got their backs to the wall. They are through.
Leave it to Galusha Reed for that.
What's the trouble?
Reed claims title to the Pivot Rock. Bill Curtin's old man bought it from a Mex who had it from a land grant. Then he made a deal with the Apaches, which seemed to cinch his title. Trouble was, Galusha Reed shows up with a prior claim. He says Fernandez had no grant, that his man Sonoma had a prior one. Old man Curtin was killed when he fell from his buckboard, and young Billy couldn't stand the gaff. He blew town after Tony Sykes buffaloed him.
What about his wife?
Gordon shook his head, then shrugged. Doubt and worry struggled on his face.
She's a fine girl, Jenny Curtin is. The salt of the earth.
It's too bad Curtin hadn't a tenth of her nerve. She'll stick, and she swears she'll fight.
Has she any men?
Two.
An old man who was with her father-in-law, and a half-breed Apache they call Rado. It used to be Silverado.
Thinking it over, Saber decided there was much left to be explained. Where had the 5,000 come from? Had Billy really run out, or had he gone away to get money to put up a battle? And how did he get it?
I'm going out. Saber got to his feet. I'll have a talk with her.
Don't take a job there. She hasn't a chance. Gordon said grimly. You'd do well to stay away.
I like fights when one side doesn't have a chance, Matt replied lightly. Maybe I will ask for a job. A man's got to die sometime. And what better time than fighting when the odds are against him?
I like to win, Gordon said flatly. I like at least a chance.
Matt Saber leaned over the table, aware that Prince McCarran had moved up behind Gordon,
and that a big man with a star was standing near him. If I decide to go work for her, Saber's voice was easy, confident, then you'd better join us. Our side will win.
Look here, you. The man wearing the star, Sid Trumbull, stepped forward. You either stay in town or get down the trail. There's trouble enough in the Mogollons. Stay out of there.
Matt looked up.
You're telling me? His voice cracked like a whip. You're town marshal, Trumbull. Not a United States marshal or a sheriff. And if you were a sheriff, it wouldn't matter. It is out of this county. Now suppose you back up and don't step into conversations unless you're invited.
Trumbull's head lowered and his face flushed red. Then he stepped around the table, his eyes narrow and mean.
Listen, you, his voice was thick with fury. No two-by-twice cowpoke tells me.
Trumbull, Saber spoke evenly. You're asking for it. You aren't acting in line of duty now. You're picking trouble, and the fact that you're marshal won't protect you.
Protect me? His fury exploded. Protect me? Why, you...
Trumbull lunged around the table, but Matt sidestepped swiftly and kicked a chair into the marshal's path. Enraged, Sid Trumbull had no chance to avoid it and fell headlong, bloodying his palms on the slivery floor. Kicking the chair away, he lunged to his feet, and Matt stood, facing him, smiling. Camp Gordon was grinning, and Hobbs was leaning his forearms on the bar, watching with relish. Trumbull stared at his torn palms, then lifted his eyes to Saber's. Then he started forward, and suddenly, in mid-stride, his hand swept for his gun. Saber palmed his Colt, and the gun barked even as it lifted. Stunned, Sid Trumbull stared at his numbed hand. His gun had been knocked spinning, and the .44 slug, hitting the trigger guard, had gone by to rip off the end of Sid's little finger. Dumbly, he stared at the slow drip of blood. Prince McCarran and Gordon were only two of those who stared not at the marshal, but at Matt Saber.
"You throw that gun mighty fast, stranger," McCarran said. "Who are you, anyway? There aren't a half dozen men in the country who can throw a gun that fast. I know most of them by sight."
Saber's eyes glinted coldly. "No?" Well, you know another one now. Call it seven men. He spun on his heel and strode from the room. All eyes followed him. 2. Matt Saber's roan headed up Shirttail Creek, crossed Bloody Basin and Skeleton Ridge, and made the Verde in the vicinity of the Hot Springs. He bedded down that night in a corner of a cliff near Hardscrabble Creek. It was late when he turned in, and he had lit no fire. He had chosen his position well, for behind him the cliff towered, and on his left there was a steep hillside that sloped away toward Hardscrabble Creek. He was almost at the foot of Hardscrabble Mesa, with the rising ground of Dead Man Mesa before him. The ground in front sloped away to the creek, and there was plenty of dry wood. The overhang of the cliff protected it from the rain. Matt Saber came suddenly awake. For an instant he lay very still. The sky had cleared, and as he lay on his side he could see the stars. He judged that it was past midnight. Why he had awakened he could not guess, but he saw that the roan was nearer, and the big gelding had his head up and ears pricked. "Careful, boy," Saber warned. Sliding out of his bedroll, he drew on his boots and got to his feet. Feeling out in the darkness, he drew his Winchester near. He was sitting in absolute blackness due to the cliff's overhang. He knew the boulders and the clumps of cedar were added concealment. The roan would be lost against the blackness of the cliff, but from where he sat, he could see some 30 yards of the creek bank and some open ground. There was subdued movement below and whispering voices. Then silence. Leaving his rifle, Saber belted on his guns and slid quietly out of the overhang and into the cedars. After a moment he heard the sound of movement, and then a low voice. "He can't be far. They said he came this way, and he left the main trail after Fossil Creek. There were two of them.
He waited, standing there among the cedars, his eyes hard and his muscles poised and ready. They were fools. Did they think he was that easy? He had fought Apaches and Kiowas, and had fought the Tuaregs in the Sahara, and the Reef in the Atlas Mountains. He saw them then, saw their dark figures moving up the hill, outlined against the pale gravel of the slope. That hard, bitter thing inside him broke loose, and he could not stand still. He could not wait. They would find the roan, and then they would not leave until they had him. It was now or never. He stepped out quickly, silently. "Looking for somebody?" They wheeled, and he saw the starlight on a pistol barrel and heard the flat, husky cough of his own gun. One went down, gasping. The other staggered, then turned and started off in a stumbling run, moaning half in fright, half in pain. He stood there, trying to follow the man, but he lost him in the brush. He turned back to the fellow on the ground, but did not go near him. He circled widely instead, returning to his horse. He quieted his roan, then lay down. In a few minutes he was dozing. Daybreak found him standing over the body. The roan was already saddled for the trail. It was one of the two he had seen in Silver City. A lean, dark-faced man with deep lines in his cheeks and a few gray hairs at the temples. There was an old scar, deep and red, over his eye. Saber knelt and went through his pockets, taking a few letters and some papers. He stuffed them into his own pockets, then mounted. Riding warily, he started up the creek. He rode with his Winchester across his saddle, ready for whatever came. Nothing did. The morning drew on, the air warm and still after the rain. A fly buzzed around his ears, and he whipped it away with his hat. The roan had a long, striding, space-eating walk. It moved out swiftly and surely toward the far purple ranges, dipping down through grassy meadows lined with pines and aspens, with here and there the whispering leaves of a tall cottonwood. It was a land to dream about, a land perfect for the grazing of either cattle or sheep, a land for a man to live in. Ahead and on his left he could see the towering Mogollon Rim, and it was beyond this rim, up on the plateau, that he would find the pivot rock. He skirted a grove of rustling aspen and looked down a long valley. For the first time he saw cattle, fat, contented cattle, fat from the rich grass of these bottomlands. Once, far off, he glimpsed a rider, but he made no effort to draw near, wanting only to find the trail to the pivot rock. A wide-mouthed canyon opened from the northeast, and he turned the roan and started up the creek that ran down it. Now he was climbing, and from the look of the country he would climb nearly 3,000 feet to reach the rim. Yet he had been told there was a trail ahead, and he pushed on. The final 800 feet to the rim was by a switchback trail that had him climbing steadily, yet the air on the plateau atop the rim was amazingly fresh and clear. He pushed on, seeing a few scattered cattle, and then he saw a crude wooden sign by the narrow trail. It read, "Pivot Rock, 1 mile." The house was low and sprawling, lying on a flat-topped knoll with the long barns and sheds built on three sides of a square. The open side faced the rim and the trail up which he was riding. There were cottonwood, pine, and fir backing up the buildings. He could see the late afternoon sunlight glistening on the coats of the saddle stock in the corral. An old man stepped from the stable with a carbine in his hands.
"All right, stranger. You stop where you are. What you want here?"
Matt Saber grinned. Lifting his hand carefully, he pushed back his flat-brimmed hat.
"Huntin' Mrs. Jenny Curtin," he said. "I've got news."
He hesitated. "Of her husband." The carbine muzzle lowered.
"Of him? What news would there be of him?"
"Not good news," Saber told him. "He's dead." Surprisingly, the old man seemed relieved.
"Light," he said briefly. "I reckon we figured he was dead. How'd it happen?"
Saber hesitated.
He picked a fight in a saloon in El Paso, then drew too slow. He was never fast. The old man studied him. My name's Tom Judson. Now, you sure didn't come all the way here from El Paso to tell us Billy was dead. What did you come for?
I'll tell Mrs. Curtin that. However, they tell me down the road you've been with her a long time, so you might as well know. I brought her some money. Bill Curtin gave it to me on his deathbed, asked me to bring it to her. It's $5,000.
$5,000? Judson stared.
Reckon Bill must have set some store by you to trust you with it.
Know him long?
Saber shook his head. Only a few minutes. A dying man hasn't much choice. A door slammed up at the house and they both turned. A slender girl was walking toward them, and the sunlight caught the red in her hair. She wore a simple cotton dress, but her figure was trim and neat. Ahead of her dashed a boy who might have been 5 or 6. He lunged at Saber, then slid to a stop and stared up at him, then at his guns.
"Howdy, old-timer," Saber said, smiling. "Where's your spurs?"
The boy was startled and shy. He drew back, surprised at the question.
I've got no spurs.
What? A cowhand without spurs?
We'll have to fix that. He looked up. How are you, Mrs. Curtin?
I'm Matthew Rann, Saber. Matt for short.
I'm afraid I've some bad news for you.
Her face paled a little, but her chin lifted.
Will you come to the house, Mr. Saber? Tom, put his horse in the corral, will you?
The living room of the ranch house was spacious and cool. There were Navajo rugs upon the floor, and the chairs and the divan were beautifully tanned cowhide. He glanced around appreciatively, enjoying the coolness after his hot ride in the Arizona sun, like the naturalness of this girl, standing in the home she had created. She faced him abruptly.
"Perhaps you'd better tell me now. There's no use pretending or putting a bold face on it when I have to be told."
As quickly and quietly as possible, he explained. When he was finished, her face was white and still.
I was afraid of this. When he rode away, I knew he would never come back. You see, he believed he had failed me. Failed his father.
Matt drew the oilskin packet from his pocket. He sent you this. He said it was $5,000. He said to give it to you. She took it, staring at the package, and tears welled into her eyes.
Yes.
Her voice was so low that Matt scarcely heard it.
He would do this. He probably felt it was all he could do for me, for us. You see,
Jenny Curtin's eyes lifted.
We're in a fight, and a bad one. This is war money. I guess Billy thought, well, he was no fighter himself, and this might help, might compensate. You're probably wondering about all this.
No, he said, I'm not. And maybe I'd better go out with the boys now. You'll want to be alone.
Wait.
Her fingers caught his sleeve.
I want you to know, since you were with him when he died, and you have come all this way to help us. There was no trouble with Billy and me. It was, well, he thought he was a coward. He thought he had failed me. We've had trouble with Galusha Reed in Yellow Jacket. Tony Sykes picked a fight with Billy. He wanted to kill him, and Billy wouldn't fight. He backed down. Everybody said he was a coward, and he ran. He went away.
Matt Saber frowned thoughtfully, staring at the floor. The boy who picked the fight with him, who dared him, who went for his gun, was no coward. Trying to prove something to himself? Maybe. But no coward. Ma'am, he said abruptly, you're his widow, the mother of his child. There's something you should know. Whatever else he was, I don't know. I never knew him long enough. But that man was no coward, not even a little bit. You see, Matt hesitated, feeling the falseness of his position, not wanting to tell this girl that he had killed her husband, yet not wanting her to think him a coward.
I saw his eyes when he went for his gun. I was there, ma'am, and saw it all. Bill Curtin was no coward. Hours later, lying in his bunk, he thought of it, and the $5,000 was still a mystery. Where had it come from? How had Curtin come by it? He turned over, and after a few minutes went to sleep. The next day, he would be writing. The sunlight was bright the next morning when he finally rolled out of bed. He bathed and shaved, taking his time, enjoying the sun on his back, and feeling glad he was footloose again. He was in the bunkhouse, belting on his guns when he heard the horses. He stepped to the door and glanced out. Neither the dark-faced Rado nor Judson was about, and there were three riders in the yard. One of them he recognized as a man from Yellow Jacket, and the tallest of the riders was Galusha Reed. He was a big man, broad and thick in the body without being fat. His jaw was brutal. Jenny Curtin came out on the steps.
"Ma'am," Reed said abruptly, "we're moving you off this land. We're going to give you 10 minutes to pack, and one of my boys will hitch the buckboard for you. This here trouble's gone on long enough, and mine's the prior claim to this land. You're getting off."
Jenny's eyes turned quickly toward the stable, but Reed shook his head.
"You needn't look for Judson or the breed. We watched till we seen them away from here, and some of my boys are covering the trail. We're trying to get you off here without any trouble."
"You can turn around and leave, Mr. Reed. I'm not going."
"I reckon you are," Reed said patiently. "We know that your man's dead. We just can't put up with you squatting on our range."
"This happens to be my range, and I'm staying."
Reed chuckled.
"Don't make us put you off, ma'am. Don't make us get rough. Up here," he waved a casual hand, "we can do anything we want, and nobody the wiser. You're leaving, as of now."
Matt Saber stepped out of the bunkhouse and took three quick steps toward the riders. He was cool and sure of himself, but he could feel the jumping invitation to trouble surging up inside him. He fought it down and held himself still for an instant. Then he spoke. "Reed, you're a fat-headed fool and a bully. You ride up here to take advantage of a woman because you think she's helpless. Well, she's not. Now you three turn your horses, turn 'em mighty careful, and start down the trail, and don't you ever set foot on this place again." Reed's face went white, then dark with anger. He leaned forward a little.
"So you're still here. Well, we'll give you a chance to run. Get going."
Matt Saber walked forward another step. He could feel the eagerness pushing up inside him, and his eyes held the three men, and he saw the eyes of one open with apprehension.
"Watch it, boss. Watch it."
"That's right, Reed. Watch it. You figured to find this girl alone. Well, she's not alone. Furthermore, if she'll take me on as a hand, I'll stay. I'll stay until you're out of the country or dead. You can have it either way you want. There's three of you. I like that. That evens us up. If you want to feed buzzards, just edge that hand another half inch toward your gun, and you can. That goes for the three of you." He stepped forward again. He was jumping with it now, that old drive for combat welling up within him. Inside, he was trembling, but his muscles were steady, and his mind was cool and ready. His fingers spread, and he moved forward again.
"Come on, you mangy coyotes! Let's see if you've got the nerve. Reach!"
Reed's face was still and cold. His mouth looked pinched, and his eyes were wide. Some sixth sense warned him that this was different. This was death he was looking at. And Galusha Reed suddenly realized he was no gambler when the stakes were so high. He could see the dark eagerness that was driving this cool man. He could see, beyond the coolness on his surface, the fierceness of his readiness. Inside, he went sick and cold at the thought.
"Boss," the man at his side whispered hoarsely, "let's get out of here. This man's poison.
Galusha Reed slowly eased his hand forward to the pommel of the saddle. So, Jenny, you're hiring gunfighters? Is that the way you want it?
I think you hired them first, she replied coolly. Now you'd better go.
On the way back, Saber suggested, you might stop in Hardscrabble Canyon and pick up the body of one of your killers. He guessed wrong last night. Reed stared at him.
I don't know what you mean, he flared. I set out no killer.
Matt Saber watched the three men ride down the trail, and he frowned. There had been honest doubt in Reed's eyes, but if he had not sent the two men after him, who had? Those men had been in Silver City and El Paso, yet they also knew this country and knew someone in Yellow Jacket. Maybe they had not come after him, but at first followed Bill Curtin. He turned and smiled at the girl. Coyotes, he said, shrugging. Not much heart in them. She was staring at him strangely.
You'd have killed them, wouldn't you? Why?
He shrugged. I don't know. Maybe it's because... Well, I don't like to see men take advantage of a woman alone. Anyway, he smiled, Reed doesn't impress me as a good citizen.
He's a dangerous enemy.
She came down from the steps.
Did you mean what you said, Mr. Saber? I mean about staying here and working for me. I need men, although I must tell you that you've small chance of winning, and it's rather a lonely fight.
Yes, I mean it. Did he mean it? Of course. He remembered the old Chinese proverb. If you save a person's life, he becomes your responsibility. That wasn't the case here, but he had killed this girl's husband, and the least he could do would be to stay until she was out of trouble. Was that all he was thinking of? I'll stay, he said. I'll see you through this. I've been fighting all my life, and it would be a shame to stop now. And I fought for lots less reasons. 3. Throughout the morning, he worked around the place. He worked partly because there was much to be done, and partly because he wanted to think. The horses in the remuda were held on the home place and were in good shape. Also, they were better than the usual ranch horses, for some of them showed a strong Morgan strain. He repaired the latch on the stable door and walked around the place, sizing it up from every angle, studying all the approaches. With his glasses, he studied the hills and searched the notches and canyons wherever he could see them. Mentally, he formed a map of all that terrain within reach of his glass. It was mid-afternoon before Judson and Rado returned, and they had talked with Jenny before he saw them.
Howdy.
Judson was friendly, but his eyes studied Saber with care. Miss Jenny tells me you run Reed off, that you're aiming to stay on here. That's right. I'll stay until she's out of trouble, if she'll have me. I don't like being pushed around. No, neither do I. Judson was silent for several moments, and then he turned his eyes on Saber. Don't you be getting any ideas about Miss Jenny. She's a fine girl. Matt looked up angrily. And don't you be getting any ideas, he said coldly. I'm helping her the same as you are, and we'll work together. As to personal things, leave them alone. I'll only say that when this fight is over, I'm hitting the trail.
All right, Judson said mildly. We can use help.
3 days passed smoothly. Matt threw himself into the work of the ranch, and he worked feverishly. Even he could not have said why he worked so desperately hard. He dug post holes and fenced an area in the long meadow near the seeping springs in the bottom. Then, working with Rado, he rounded up the cattle nearest the rim and pushed them back behind the fence. The grass was thick and deep there and would stand a lot of grazing, for the meadow wound back up the canyon for some distance. He carried a running iron and branded stock wherever he found it required. As the ranch had been shorthanded for a year, there was much to do. Evenings he mended gear and worked around the place, and at night he slept soundly.
During all this time, he saw nothing of Jenny Curtin. He saw nothing of her, but she was constantly in his thoughts. He remembered her as he had seen her that first time, standing in the living room of the house, listening to him, her eyes wide and dark upon his face. He remembered her facing Galusha Reed and his riders from the steps. Was he staying on because he believed he owed her a debt, or because of her? Here and there around the ranch, Saber found small, intangible hints of the sort of man Curtin must have been. Judson had liked him, and so had the half-breed. He had been gentle with horses. He had been thoughtful. Yet he had hated and avoided violence. Slowly, rightly or wrongly, Matt could not tell, a picture was forming in his mind of a fine young man who had been totally out of place. Western birth, but born for peaceful and quiet ways, he had been thrown into a cattle war and had been aware of his own inadequacy. Matt was thinking of that and working at a rawhide riata when Jenny came up. He had not seen her approach, or he might have avoided her. But she was there beside him before he realized it.
"You're working hard, Mr. Saber."
"To earn my keep, ma'am. There's a lot to do, I find, and I like to keep busy." He turned the riata and studied it. "You know, there's something I've been wanting to talk to you about. Maybe it's none of my affair, but young Billy is going to grow up, and he's going to ask questions about his dad. You aren't going to be able to fool him. Maybe you know what this is all about, and maybe I'm mounting on the offside, but it seems to me that Bill Curtin went to El Paso to get that money for you. I think he realized he was no fighting man, and that the best thing he could do was to get that money so he could hire gunfighters. It took nerve to do what he did, and I think he deliberately took what Sykes handed him because he knew that if Sykes killed him, you'd never get that money. Maybe along the way to El Paso he began to wonder. And maybe he picked that fight down there with the idea of proving to himself that he did have the nerve to face a gun." She did not reply, but stood there, watching his fingers work swiftly and evenly, plating the leather.
"Yes," she said finally. "I thought of that. Only I can't imagine where he got the money. I hesitate to use it without knowing."
"Don't be foolish," he said irritably. "Use it. Nobody would put it to better use, and you need gun hands."
"But who would work for me?"
Her voice was low and bitter.
"Galusha Reed has seen to it that no one will."
"Maybe if I rode in, I could find some men." He was thinking of Camp Gordon, the Shakespeare-quoting English cowhand. "I believe I know one man."
"There's a lot to be done. Judd tells me you've been doing the work of three men."
Matt Saber got to his feet. She stepped back a little, suddenly aware of how tall he was. She was tall for a girl, yet she came no farther than his lips. She drew back a little at the thought. Her eyes dropped to his guns. He always wore them, always low and tied down.
"Judson said you were a fast man with a gun. He said you had the mark of the gunfighter."
"Probably." He found no bitterness at the thought. "I've used guns. Guns and horses, they're about all I've known."
"Where were you in the army? I've watched you walk and ride, and you show military training."
"Oh, several places. Africa, mostly."
"Africa?"
She was amazed.
"You've been there?"
He nodded. "Desert and mountain country. Morocco and the Sahara, all the way to Timbuktu and Lake Chad, fighting most of the time." It was growing dark in the shed where they were standing. He moved out into the dusk. A few stars had already appeared, and the red glow that was in the west beyond the rim was fading. "Tomorrow I'll ride in and have a look around. You'd better keep the other men close by." Dawn found him well along on the trail to Yellow Jacket. It was a long ride, and he skirted the trail most of the time, having no trust in well-traveled ways at such a time. The air was warm and bright, and he noticed a few head of Pivot Rock steers that had been overlooked in the rounding up of cattle along the rim. He rode ready for trouble, his Winchester across his saddle bows, his senses alert. Keeping the roan well back under the trees, he had the benefit of the evergreen needles that formed a thick carpet and muffled the sound of his horse's hoofs. Yet, as he rode, he considered the problem of the land grant. If Jenny were to retain her land and be free of trouble, he must look into the background of the grant and see which had the prior and best claim, Fernandez or Sonoma. Next, he must find out, if possible, where Bill Curtin had obtained that $5,000. Some might think that the fact he had it was enough and that now his wife had it, but it was not enough if Bill had sold any rights to water or land on the ranch, or if he had obtained the money in some way that would reflect upon Jenny or her son. When those things were done, he could ride on about his business, for by that time he would have worked out the problem of Galusha Reed. In the few days he had been on the Pivot Rock, he had come to love the place, and while he had avoided Jenny, he had not avoided young Billy. The youngster had adopted him and had stayed with him hour after hour. To keep him occupied, Matt had begun teaching him how to plait rawhide, and so, as he mended riatas and repaired bridles, the youngster had sat beside him, working his fingers clumsily through the intricacies of the plaiting. It was with unease that he recalled his few minutes alone with Jenny. He shifted his seat in the saddle and scowled. It would not do for him to think of her as anything but Curtin's widow. The widow, he reflected bitterly, of the man he had killed. What would he say when she learned of that? He avoided the thought, yet it remained in the back of his mind, and he shook his head, wanting to forget it. Sooner or later she would know, and if he did not finally tell her himself, then he was sure that Reed would let her know. Avoiding the route by way of Hardscrabble, Matt Saber turned due south.